Welcome to the XYZ Experiment podcast. Today in the studio, I've got myself and Fiona, and we are joined by Dr. Kate Gould, who is a clinical neuropsychologist and a senior research fellow at Monash University. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you. Great to be here.
We are going to get into a little bit of the what and the how of your work shortly, but maybe to start us off, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I am a millennial. I live in Melbourne with my husband, my standard poodle, and my talking parrot.
You have a parrot?
I do.
How does the parrot and the poodle get along?
They are great buddies. The parrot is a very assertive, little, colourful dragon creature. And the giant dog is the gentle giant.
Oh.
But they're very sweet. They play a tug of war together. They steal each other's food. The dog chases the bird as she flies through the house. They're quite a riot.
Wow. That is amazing. I've always wanted a bird, but I have a dog, so I didn't think it was possible. But you have given me hope that that might be in my future.
What does the bird? What does the bird say? What sort of speaking does it do?
She says hello, bye bye, have a bath, and she does a lot of animal noises like magpies. She roars, she meows, she barks, she quacks.
I need a photo.
You have to send us
or a video of this bird and dog together. What do you do for a career?
I have two hats, really. I'm a clinical neuropsychologist, and that is a type of psychologist that specializes in people with neurological issues, particularly around the cognitive, emotional, and behavioral issues that people can experience. I personally specialize in acquired brain injury rehabilitation in the community. So I'm working with people over the really long term. I'm helping them with everyday difficulties of their routines, their relationships, and their well-being, and trying to help them have a really good life. Mm. So I really love that work. It's really rewarding. So I'm driving out and seeing people in their homes and working with them and their families and their teams to address the issues that are getting in the way of them living a good life. And then on the other side, I'm a academic at Monash University, where I'm researching very similar topics really around acquired brain injury rehabilitation, and particularly interested in challenging behaviours, so things like aggression, inappropriate behaviours, and psychiatric problems, tracking long-term what issues people are experiencing and looking at interventions. And then a third key area would be around cyber safety and the vulnerability that people with brain injury are particularly experiencing in this modern world with scams just absolutely everywhere.
And we ask this question of all of our guests. You've already told us you're a millennial. What is the most millennial thing about you?
I thought a lot about this question because it's not really the way I normally think about myself, but I'd have to say that it's probably the music I like.
Yes.
And the fact that the music that was popular as I was growing up in the 90s and the 2000s really didn't use auto-tune. And so I really struggle with auto-tune music, and I kind of just revert back to the earlier, more, in my mind, kind of authentic voice.
But it's just interesting because I was driving and we've got a new car, and I didn't know how to, like, our radio stations aren't tuned in. Like,
yeah.
Anyway, stumbled across Gold 104.3.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Whatever, yeah. Three. The Cores were on, which I grew up listening to the Cores, loved the Cores. Yeah. I was like, I always thought Gold 104.3 was like oldies music.
No.
Now it's my music. Yeah. Yeah. It's my music.
Yeah. Yeah, so what bands or singers do you like?
Well, I loved the Cores. I had that CD.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it seems like younger people, like, they've never used CDs.
No.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I had a really broad range of music I liked, like classical music and violin and hip-hop and soul and indie music. bit of everything, really.
Well, we've heard a little bit about the work that you do, and you mentioned cyber safety, and I have always considered it as cyber crime. So I'm wondering, can you unpack what is cyber safety / cyber crime?
So cyber crime is like an overarching term for different crimes that utilize computers and the internet. So that could be like computer viruses and hacking.
Oh, yes.
And cyberbullying all kind of come under that umbrella. And my work has really focused on cyber scams specifically, which is a type of cybercrime.
Yeah. And scams can also exist, I guess, outside of computers, but you're looking at computer-driven cyber scams?
Yeah, so scams which use technology. So that could be through email or social media or even a telephone call, text messages as well. So scams have existed for obviously before the internet has been around, but the internet has made access to potential victims much easier, and the scale of cybercrime and cyber scams is now incredibly advanced and significant, to the extent that cyber scams are now the number one or number two crime in most countries in the world.
Really?
Because when I think about cyber scams nowadays, a lot of them back in the day used to be a bit funny, you know, the Nigerian prince or something like that. Like, oh, that's just ridiculous. But they seem so sophisticated now that they're fooling even the smartest people and the smartest corporations, and it just seems to have got to a really extreme and complicated level. Would that be true to say?
Definitely. It's now actually often run by organized crime internationally, and they have significant funding to invest in this lucrative industry of scamming. So, for example, last year, Australians lost $2.7 billion to scams, and the year before, $3 billion. And so this is now in the trillions of dollars worldwide, trillions and trillions. So the resources they have to develop their technology to make it so sophisticated that it is creating victims of people that previously we thought were safe. Now, no one is safe.
Mm.
Everyone can be scammed, and it's not about how smart you are, how educated you are, whether or not you know about some scams. There are so many different scams on every platform and targeting everyone in society. We know that, for example, there are scams that target academics with fake journals and fake conferences, where you're paying for conference fees for conferences that don't exist, or academic journals, you're paying processing fees for fake journals. There are scams where they hack into your email and change banking details for major payments because they're tracking those things. And there was a story in the news today about someone who was putting their deposit for their home and even checked with their bank about the payment details, and the bank cleared it, and it was a scam and they lost their deposit money. So it's actually the most common scam in Australia right now is investment scams. And they might be from people who are very experienced with investments and have done it very safely and very carefully. But now the scammers completely clone websites and take over communication in such sophisticated ways that even very experienced people are losing money to these scams.
And even some of the warnings that get put out there, like, we will never ask for your personal details in an email, you know, we'll never ask you to click on a link, you know, we'll tell you to log into your account, etc. But even recently, I almost was scammed because I got a text message, an email, and a voice message, because I couldn't answer the phone, all saying that my Westpac credit card had been hacked, and that I needed to log in and do something, right? But all three of those communication methods, and I was thinking, I've never banked with Westpac. And so then I was like, has my husband taken out a Westpac credit card that I didn't know? So then I'm like calling him, and I was like, do we have a Westpac credit card? And he's like, no, we don't. That's fraud. Like, don't don't respond. And I was like, but they got my email, my mobile phone number, work email, mind you, and they called me, sounded super professional, knew my name. I was like, wowzers.
And if you did have a Westpac account, you might have thought that was real.
Oh, 100%, because they didn't ask for my details in any of their comms. It's scary.
So it just shows, like, there are millions of Australians who bank with Westpac. So they can just do that scam over and over again for the big four banks, and they have then got most of our population. But what you did is actually best practice, Dash, so well done. Because you stopped and you thought, this doesn't seem right.
Yeah.
So that first thing to do is to not click, to not just jump in, but to take a moment to pause, to think about it. I don't have a Westpac account, or I didn't enter that lottery. How am I winning a prize? Well, this doesn't seem quite right. And then the second thing you did was you checked with someone you trusted. So you called up your hubby and you said, What's going on here? I got this information. And so he's not in the moment. He's not getting that rush of fear, which is what they've tried to do to manipulate you by saying your account has, you know, been hacked and you need to change these details. That gets you that fear and that urgency, I better respond. And he's separated from that and he can see things a bit more clearly. So those are really good. And then the last thing that you might want to do is block and report, because the more that ScamWatch and Westpac and other agencies know about those sorts of scams coming through, the more they can see the trends of what's targeting Australians and respond to it.
Okay.
How do they respond? What can they do for that?
So more and more they are working to address the kind of system gaps in how scams are coming to us, and liaising, for example, with the telcos to block those numbers, to block those accounts that are sending scams, and to run education campaigns. So we all kind of need to work together. We need the community to be better informed and armed to know what to look out for and what's good practice. But we also need the government and industry to be doing a lot more to stop that even happening to you in the first place.
So, Kate, I'm curious as to, you know, you talked about your clinical work and then your research work. How did you get into this space of cyber safety and cybercrime?
It's a really great question, because it's not necessarily what I thought I was going to be doing. But funnily enough, if you go back to the 90s when I was at school and entering science competitions as a nerd, I actually entered a competition with a cyber safety video about helping kids stay safe online, and won an award for that.
Wow.
And then who would know that, yeah, I think that was something like 1994, and then 2014 was actually when this entered my world again. Unfortunately, in my private practice, I was working with a man. I'd been working with him for a couple of years, and he'd had a severe brain injury. And his name is Colin. And he was unfortunately the victim to a romance scam. And he was losing money. He was spending a lot of his time talking to these scammers. We don't even know it's just one person. Often it's multiple people. And it was a huge relief for him when he told me about it. But he was really struggling to disengage, because these scammers were saying these very beautiful things to him, like, I don't care you've got a brain injury. I think you're amazing. I love you. I want to come to Australia and live with you, and we're going to have a beautiful life together. And that was so compelling for him, so attractive. And he was spending all his time online through all the hours of the night, not properly sleeping. He dropped out of his hobbies, and it was really taking over his life. And so for myself as his clinician, I had to figure out how to disengage him from this kind of addiction to her loving approach, but also the drama that she was pulling him into, like, you know, there's going to be an investment for gold and we're going to get rich and you can be the investor in that. And now I'm in jail and I need money for food. And he was the hero of these stories. He could help and give that money to change her life. And there were different characters that would come in, police and lawyers, and he was speaking to all of them. And they spent a lot of energy building up this world with kind of social engineering to kind of create greater trust. And so it was very hard for me to come in an hour a fortnight and try to turn that off. And what I ended up doing was trying to use all of the clinical tools that I had to date, and nothing was working. Mm. And then I was looking online, what's best practice here? There was nothing. All the guidance really said was, if you've been scammed, stop sending money, speak to the bank and the police. And if you're struggling emotionally, consult a mental health professional. But there was no guidance on what a mental health professional should do, because you're dealing with that grooming, the psychological manipulation, the distress, the betrayal, and this sort of addictive aspect of continuing to give money to stay engrossed in this drama. And it was really confronting. I was trying for a really long time. And what ended up happening, what ended up being helpful, was that Colin and I started learning about scams together. And we turned it into a project of, could this help other people? So we collated all of our learnings, but also each of our personal experiences, Colin from the perspective of being through a romance scam, and me from the perspective of trying to help him. And we put it together into a presentation, and we took that to our clinic where I was working to show other people with brain injury and other clinicians. And there was a real kind of eye-opening experience for a lot of them. They hadn't thought about scams online. This is 10 years ago, when at the time, particularly in brain injury rehab, the benefits of technology and smart apps and the internet were really exciting in the brain injury space, because we could connect people, we could help them with their memory and organization with apps and all sorts of things, and no one was talking about the risk side. Mm-hmm. And so from there, we ended up being keynote speakers at a brain injury conference. And that was a really important event that happened at that conference, where there was another gentleman in the audience who'd had a brain injury, and he heard Colin speak, and he turned to his support worker and said, "Oh, what's happened to Colin? I think that's happening to me too." Wow. And so for hearing Colin's story, it was helping people recognize that they were being scammed. And that's actually pretty amazing, because a lot of people are often in denial and very invested emotionally, cognitively, financially in the scam being true. That's people with and without brain injury. So that gentleman, his name was Alf, and he actually joined our team, and we ended up conducting together education sessions in Melbourne, Tasmania, and online. And then it started the research aspect as well, because I really wanted to understand, is this just me? Is this happening across the board? What are other clinicians experiencing with their clients? And do they have the answers? Do they know what's going on? So we evaluated our workshops that we had been doing to see if that was helping clinicians. And we conducted a survey across Australia and New Zealand to see, are other people seeing clients with brain injury who'd been scammed? And we surveyed over 100 service providers and clinicians, and we found 53% at that time had clients who were scammed.
Wow.
And that's one in two. Yeah.
Yeah. And that a third of those people were having multiple scams. The scams were lasting on average 5 months. And they were mostly romance scams, like Colin's experience. So that was quite confronting and surprising. And the other aspect was that I asked clinicians, you know, what are you doing? What are you finding that's helpful? Is there anything that's really working in this space? And they didn't have anything that was a highly effective approach. So what was actually happening in a lot of cases was that clinicians were just feeling completely unprepared and really feeling out of their depth and having no clue as to what to do in this situation. And many individuals were unfortunately, because of the scam, it was really framed as because of your brain injury, you're being scammed and you clearly don't have the capacity to safely manage your finances. And so we're going to bring in a financial administrator now to take over your funds and you're going to lose that independence, or you're no longer able to independently and safely manage being on the internet. So you won't be able to access the internet anymore, or your phone, or do that independently. So it actually kind of presented with a human rights aspect as well. And that wasn't always actually resulting in benefits for the person. They were getting really frustrated. They were angry. For people that were still online but had no money, they were often still engaging with, for example, a romance scammer who was now becoming aggressive towards them. Where's that money? Why has that stopped? And then the person's getting really upset, blaming their family. It's because of you. I can't help my girlfriend's sick mother who's in hospital or the jail, or I'm not getting that investment. So it was causing a lot of family conflict and distress. And we were seeing just really significant emotional impacts for people. But then this other layer of the social relationship impacts and the independence aspects as well. And so that research really helped to solidify for me this real need for us to do a lot more in this space.
I mean, that is, I had goosebumps listening to that story and like how layered it is in terms of impacts. And I just can't get over like the grief that Colin must have been having to deal with alongside then the financial and, you know, the implications around all of those elements of being scammed like that. But that's a romance scam is like, there's a real relationship loss with that.
That's right. Yeah. So people often feel a great, on the one hand, a great sense of shame and feel like an idiot. I've been tricked. I've been fooled. And people are often contributing to that. You're an idiot. You shouldn't have fallen for that. It should be obvious. Back in the day of the Nigerian
prince,
that seemed like an easy thing to kind of spot, but they're not easy anymore. And so, yeah, you have on that one side the shame of being scammed, but then on the other side, particularly for people in a romance scam, the victim's emotions are real.
Yes.
Fake. And as we know, if you've ever had a breakup, you can't switch your emotions off on a dime. It takes time. And there's a grief process and there's a loss process and there's a wanting it to be true and real. And so people go through that denial, disbelief, confusion, and having a brain injury on top of that just makes it so much harder to work through that complex emotions and that cognitive dissonance. And then on top of that, change your behavior to actually stop engaging with the scammer. It's really hard.
And then being afraid of having any sort of relationship after that, that loss of trust in yourself and others online would be devastating.
Exactly. People go through a lot of grief around the aspect of trust. Mm. Like, I really trusted this person. I will say Colin is still leading this project with me 10 years in, and we have arranged now a whole team of scambassadors who have been through this experience. One of our other scambassadors, he was in a romance scam for 6 years.
Yeah.
So that was meeting a need for him, and there was some aspects of the scam and those red flags that he kind of did recognize, but he described it beautifully as, I stepped over those red flags because I wanted that relationship to be real. And people want to trust. That's how our world operates. We have to trust people to an extent. And I think scams are really jeopardizing that really important human value and need and relational imperative for us to trust each other. And so they are questioning, can I trust anyone? Can I trust myself? I missed this. And people are going from extremes of, like, I used to be trusting and trust everyone and see that as a good quality, which it is. It's a really generous quality, but there are risks to that. And then they'll sort of swing back the other way and now trust no one. And so we were seeing that to a really significant extent with people in our studies with brain injury, where there was a romance scam and she was female, and so now I don't trust females, including my sister and my daughter, who are my key supports. I don't trust them now even.
Oh, wow.
And that's really problematic if you're really dependent on your social support, and we are all dependent on our social connections. And so we're trying to help people find a balance and that healthy level of trust, and also holding some skepticism and suspicion when we're engaging with strangers or unexpected text messages and emails.
Because what I'm really getting from this conversation, which I'd never had a thought before, and I think a societal's very much this way, when we talk about scammers, we really talk about the financial scam. We're forgetting the psychological scam. That's massive, like probably maybe even more damaging than the financial, to be honest.
That's correct, and that's what the research is showing. And that even if people don't lose money, there can be still that betrayal. Yeah. And with artificial intelligence, that is just creating more and more Pandora's boxes of problems. So, for example, there's been a scam where all of us right now are giving our audio data to the internet. And people are on YouTube and social media with their voice and their face. And there's a scam where they take a clip of your daughter speaking and they use that to be able to make her say anything through technology. And they're using that, there was that "Hi Mum" scam, "I've lost my phone, please send me $2,000, I'm using my friend's phone and account." And that was getting a lot of people, or "Hi Dad" scam. But unfortunately, there's been one where it's presented that the daughter's been kidnapped, and it's actually her voice on the phone saying, "Mum, help me, I've been kidnapped, you've got to give them the money."
Wow.
And so this has happened, and it's been crushingly devastating, as you can imagine. And so people are incredibly upset and distressed, and they might still not get to the point of giving the money. Somebody steps in, or they call the daughter and find out she's okay. But like the relief, the kind of trauma of that is really substantial.
So Kate, I know you've been doing some work around initiatives to address some of these impacts. What does that look like, and what are you doing? And is that also with Colin?
Yes. Yes. Amazing. So Colin is an amazing collaborator in this work. And we have a team of researchers, PhD students, clinicians, people from industry, government, and we have a kind of suite of solutions, because it's pretty distressing to think only about the problem and explore that. And I really, my work with the Monash Epworth Rehabilitation Research Centre, I lead a theme on co-design and community translation. And so all of our resources are co-designed in a very intensive, collaborative, authentic way with stakeholders, including scam victims and family members, carers and clinicians. And we have three key solutions. One is on the prevention and awareness side. So building up from those talks Colin and Alf and I and our team Anna were doing, we had funding from the Transport Accident Commission, and we co-designed a free self-paced online training program developed for people with brain injury by people with brain injury. And that includes videos of people sharing their tips about how to spot and avoid red flags. Just like we saw that Alf was so compelled and influenced by Colin's talk, we really want to be people talking to people about their experiences rather than the professionals coming in and telling you what to do. So that's available at our website, cyberability.org.au, and we're evaluating that, and we can see that it is having an impact and helping people avoid being scammed. The second aspect is measurement. How do we know how vulnerable someone is to being scammed and whether our interventions are effective? So my PhD student, Jiao Carminati, her work was to co-design an evidence-based screening tool where you could self-assess with like a quiz of some questions and some scam detection tasks to identify your vulnerability and your strength. And that comes up with your own individualized profile of what elements you have strengths in and what you might need some extra tips and tools in. So that's also available at our website. And then finally, 10 years in, we are very excitingly at the point of now having an intervention that would go back to, if I had this at the time that I found out Colin was scammed, that would have been exactly what I needed. So again, with the funding of the Transport Accident Commission in Victoria, we spent all of last year co-designing a psychological intervention to actually help people who had been scammed work through and recover. And as far as we know, this is the first evidence-based, co-designed psychological intervention for scam victims with brain injury. And we're currently trialing that. It's a group program and it's co-delivered by Colin and Jimmy and our other scam ambassadors to really open up the discussion and help people feel less stigma and less shame and feel more open to talking this through. And so we've just finished last week our first group therapy with five people who've been, we've had a face-to-face group and an online group, and that's been just an absolutely amazing experience to bring people together and to see how they've supported each other and worked through the trauma, the shame, the distress, and come out the other side feeling more confident, more empowered, more adjusted.
Yeah.
So far.
The power of story is really important, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I mean, how lucky are you that you had Colin to share his story? That's it. Because a lot of people would be afraid to do that. It's extraordinary.
Absolutely. It's every time I appreciate the courage it takes because even though this is now 10 years ago, it's still there. It's still something he's gone through that's hard, hard to talk about. And I think, though, that what's really beautiful with these people's real stories is the things that the scammers were trying to take advantage of, that generosity, that trust, that giving, that's now what people like Colin are using to genuinely help others. And it was so empowering for him to see Alf connect the dots and see the impact his stories had. And we've gone on to see that for many, many more people. And it can really fill a need in a much more valuable way to help others. Yeah.
When people get scammed online, like these romance scams that we're talking about, is it people looking for community? And then by you forming these groups, we're giving them an alternative community connection?
Yeah, I think so. One of the risk factors is being lonely, being bored, seeking connection. And so that is a powerful basic human need. During COVID as well, we were so disconnected, and some of the people in our groups have talked about not only just that connection, but that the scammers are very cleverly meeting a need for people to be understood about their injury and their trauma. And some people have felt that their own families and friends weren't being supportive and understanding. And so that's so critical that we have trusted people to provide that that connection, that support, that understanding, rather than the scammers. It says a lot, really, about how we support people with disability, with trauma, with injury, that the scammers are so effective through that means.
Because if we take a leaf from the scammers' book, they are filling a need.
Yeah.
They are. And so how can we then reverse that on its head, that we as a community can fulfill that need for that person without a financial reward behind it? You know what I mean? Like a genuine connection with them.
Yeah. And it is what we're all trying to do in rehab as clinicians. We are trying to create community and support. And it's often, I think, it's really hard, particularly with, for example, traumatic brain injury, that's typically 75% male, car accidents, people in their 20s and 30s who are at a time of just establishing their careers, their relationships, their adult friendships, and an injury that changes your behaviour, your personality, your sense of humour, your ability to go to the pub, to work. Friends often stick around at the start when their friend has gone through a serious accident, But over time, people kind of drift away and their lives separate from someone who's studying, getting a career, building a family, to someone who's not. And people with a brain injury, it's a lifelong disability. And there are decades and decades ahead of them, which can be lonely and hard and filled with well-intentioned family and paid clinicians and services. But that deeper connection and understanding is really hard to find. And the scammers are, trawling people's Facebook profiles, and they see, car accident, they see trauma, and they connect through that trauma.
Wowzers. So it's like also being really careful about what you put out about yourself on these social media platforms, that might alert people that you're vulnerable. But I do take your point in terms of, how are we there for people in our community? Because, Kate, you're amazing in that clinical role, and the empathy that you have is like shining through. Absolutely. Like, you didn't give up on this problem or kind of go, oh, it's like, let's, how do we fix this? But I guess to the general community and our society, it's like understanding, what would you say to the community for people who might be vulnerable or lonely, but also who might have gone through a scam? What is the best response we should have to our friends and family?
Well, yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. Empathy is so important because coming at the person with anger and blame and judgment can actually turn them back to the scammer.
Yeah.
So coming to the extent of, or coming to the person with an approach of understanding, openness, genuine curiosity, and acknowledgement that scams are happening to everyone and it's not your fault.
Yeah.
If your house is robbed, it is not your fault. You took steps to protect it, but the criminals who want to get in will get in. And we have to kind of pull back this sense of you're at fault if you've been scammed. People just can't protect themselves 100%. No one can. So if you are supportive and helpful in a practical and emotional way, then there's a chance that you will pull that person out of that entanglement with the scammer and actually help them on that path towards adjustment.
And then you also, I know you work in the area of brain injury, acquired brain injury, but for the general community who might get scammed, is the advice also still to, like, if they're feeling distressed, hook into, general practice, mental health professionals around this space?
Yes, I think for the time being, there aren't a huge number of specialist options out there.
Yeah.
Some people describe that when they call Scamwatch, for example, to call and report a scam, that that can be quite validating and helpful. There's also ID Care, which is focused on identity theft, but also provides some limited support as well from that sort of emotional aspect. And then we are open to referrals for Australians who are struggling with a scam experience as well.
I've heard of a few scams within families where, like, particularly with the fathers, where the mother's passed away, they've got older, older children, and dad all of a sudden's got a love interest online. And I know from not my own experience, but from experiences that I've heard, there is so much anger. The kids are like, "Why is dad doing that? This is ridiculous. Like, can't he see?" And they get really upset about it. But you're right about following it with compassion. Like, but it would be hard. It would be so hard.
Very much. And
Yeah.
for that reason, we also invite the family members into the therapy program as well.
Yeah.
And that's been really valuable. Also, it turns out that often these family members, they've had, or friends, they've had scams themselves too.
Yeah.
And that can be very validating to our individuals with brain injury to say it's not just because of the brain injury you've been
Yeah.
scammed.
Yeah.
It Your friend got a cryptocurrency scam,
Yeah.
and your daughter, she had a PayPal scam. So these things are just around and they're pervasive, and it's a very understandable reaction to be angry. I think that's because we as a community, we don't understand enough about what is going on with these scams. Because coming back to the start of the conversation, the Nigerian Prince scam seemed so easy to spot, and it's just not the same anymore, particularly around romance scams, where the scammers are investing hours and hours every day and spending time talking to this person and building a whole rich life and romance. It's very difficult to spot when you're in it.
I saw something not long ago about some of the scammers themselves are human traffickers, that they have been trafficked into this job. Can you speak to that at all? Is that true?
Yes. So there are actually tens of thousands of people that are forced into kind of like scam workshops. Might be brought in from another country and have their passports taken away and forced to spend hours running these scams, which are often scripted. And there might be even different departments, like a department to trawl and find scam victims, and then somebody to do the kind of setup and rope people in, and then somebody to do the romance part, and then somebody to ask for the money. And then there's even a second wave of scams, like you find out that you've been scammed, and then they come at you with, you know, we'll help you get the money back. We're lawyers, we're law enforcement, and that's another scam. And so, yeah, there's whole departments, and they're staffed by thousands of people sometimes. And it's a very complex crime, because they can, law enforcement might come in and shut down that organization, and they can't arrest thousands of people. They might deport them back to their original countries. But within a week, if a place had 1,000 staff, they've got 500 back and they're going again. So when you think about the scale and the funding and the human impact of this, it becomes a very tall order to ask everyone in our community to skill up with the latest technology and the latest understanding of how sophisticated they are. We do need to do that, but we need, you know, we need a kind of like military level response to what's happening to us.
Can I ask about the financial aspect of it? Because obviously all of this money is online that's been transferred. Why can't banks do more about that?
There's actually legislation being looked at right now to make the banks, and the approach that they're taking in Australia is sort of the telcos and the social media platforms as well now be more liable to fines and fees for not doing more. We haven't gone to the extent that the UK has gone, where the bank that receives the money and the bank that sends the money have 50-50 responsibility to repay the victim. There's a real push against that in Australia, but the impact in the UK has been that that really incentivizes the banks to stop the scams even happening in the first place, so they don't have to repay victims. But right now, the repayment level is between 2-5% if you've been scammed.
That's very low.
And, you know, just going back to the fact that I think the number of people being scammed is underreported, because I'm now thinking, based on your examples, I've been scammed at least 5 times.
You have?
Yeah, and one time was on a home deposit that someone had hacked into the people we were giving the deposit to, and they had sent us an email and say from that person's email account saying, this is the account number. We're changing all of our systems, right? It's only because my husband like followed up and was like, we didn't get a receipt. And they were like, you didn't give us a payment. And actually the builder ended up having to absorb that cost. So we weren't out of money because it was a scam that happened on their end. Like their security wasn't
up to scratch.
But it took so much, and I'm just thinking there must be so much underreporting of scams because people aren't realising, and I didn't even know, oh, I should actually go now with that Westpac situation and report that. Like, I didn't, that is my responsibility, I should do that. I'm just like, oh, that was annoying, that was a bloody scam.
I think it goes to show how important it is that we talk about these scams more regularly. I would love it to be at the dinner table that we're talking as families and friends about the latest scams, because that's how you connected the dots.
Yes.
I wasn't telling you what to do. I was just talking about this generally. And then you can relate to that and trawl back in your mind and go, oh, just like Alf in my story, that happened to you as well.
Yeah.
Like just right now. It's amazing, isn't it?
I've gone the opposite way in that because my husband's a software engineer, he's really drummed it into me over the years about never respond or press or do it, like really strongly. Or if a scam comes through and he'll go to me, oh, he'll send me a text to say, oh, that's a scam. I got it as well. Don't do anything about it. That it's made me quite paranoid. Like even like I went to the movies the other night and then Hoyt sent me a text message to say, you know, you saw this movie, do a quiz for us about it and you could win $1,000 worth of tickets. I didn't press on it because I thought that's probably not real. Because that's how I've gone now. I've gone completely the other way about not pressing on any links sent to me anymore. Or if I get a bank one, which I've had before, I just ring my bank. Ring my bank manager and go, hey, well, this just came through.
And I think that's a healthy level of suspicion. Yeah. And I think that's what we need to be like now.
Yeah.
And I'm the same. If I get contacted by someone and it might be legitimate, I am very suspicious. People need to earn my trust now instead of having it for granted. And that doesn't protect me from 100% of scams. I've had scams too, but it does help. And I think, unfortunately, that's what we need when we're contacted by people we can't verify very easily.
Yeah.
Mm.
But it's amazing how even just really trusted brands are just, the scams are incredible. You know, they look so real.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that quiz with Hoyts, it might have been real, but what happens to that data that you provide? What kind of questions are they asking you about your personal information?
Yeah.
And what they probably are selling it to market third parties that then get hacked by scammers that then get to the point where Dash had her mobile number, her name, and her email address all connected. And that's what's happening with these big hacking incidents, coming back to a broader type of cybercrime, which we have no control over. And all that data gets sold on the black market and bought by scammers to be able to boost that social engineering and make it seem so legitimate, like Dash thought. This, how could they possibly know all this information?
I know, 100%. But then I think about how often I put my mobile number, email address down on different things and my name every time I pay for, like, buy online crap. But it's just incredible because, like, I know a lot of my friends and family have quit Facebook because of scams on Facebook Marketplace. Like, it's everywhere. Oh, wowzers, this has been, like, a conversation that's, like, blowing my mind as to how much I'm vulnerable to scams. I'm going to do the quiz. So we'll put the cyber ability link in the show notes. But the other thing I also wanted to just make sure we mentioned was your podcast, Relentless Optimism. Tell us a little bit about your podcast.
I think that's a really great phrase to bring to this part of the conversation. Yes. 'Cause it can feel pretty disheartening to talk about the scam issues that we're all facing. So I am relentlessly optimistic. I think that we can work together as a society, as individuals, as a community, with this broader industry systems to improve this, and that's why we're doing all of this work. But Relentless Optimism as a podcast actually relates to a different area of my work around helping people with challenging behaviours after brain injury, so things like aggression and socially inappropriate behaviour or disinhibition or even lack of initiation. We've been trialing a positive behavior support approach called PBS Plus that helps specifically people with brain injury and adults in the community and an inpatient level, but PBS is applied more broadly to kids, people with learning disabilities, intellectual disability, and other reasons for behavior issues. And it's a really humanist, authentic, person-driven approach to help people build a meaningful life and build skills to self-regulate behavior particularly those that have become obstacles to their good life. So in this podcast, we talk about the research with like Jenny Ponsford and Tim Feeney. And we also, I interview people who've been through our program in our randomized controlled trial. So people with brain injury, family members, carers, and their clinicians to unpack this PBS Plus intervention from their own experience. And that's really amazing to hear. We don't often hear about the lived experience and the voices of people with behaviour issues themselves talking that through and about what they've taken from their time in the intervention with us. So it's come to both of those areas of research. We have now clinics at the Turner Clinics at Monash University for people who are studying to be clinicians like neuropsychologists and other allied health. They can be on placement with me, and we have the Cyber Ability Clinic and a positive behaviour service as well, to teach others these approaches on top of other clinical tools to really build our capacity as clinicians and as a community to better help people with these really significant problems of behaviour issues and scams as well.
Amazing. The work you're doing is so amazing, Kate.
Like, so important.
So important.
So important in today's world, seriously.
Wowzers. And, you know, even just the fact that you highlighted Colin's story and the scams that were happening 10 years ago, and now we're in 2024, they're getting more and more sophisticated. But, you know, thinking about even your podcast and the interventions that you've developed and the clinics that you're running, like, that's just incredible. So we'll link all of that in our show notes. And thank you so much for coming on. Was there anything else you wanted to share with our listeners about the work you do, or any tips or tricks or messages around what you've been researching?
Gosh, I could keep going for another hour. There's so much, I guess, I wish people knew, but I think particularly in my area of acquired brain injury, I think something I'd like the broader community to know is that this is an invisible disability, and people even with severe brain injury with significant memory problems and processing speed problems, you might not be able to tell from a conversation that they are experiencing those difficulties. And so I would love the broader community to be more patient, more empathic, more of giving people the benefit of the doubt. We don't know what someone else is going through. And when someone cuts you off in traffic, when somebody jumps in line and is a bit maybe rude or impatient, it might be that there's a lot more going on behind the scenes for that person. And that's beyond brain injury. That's, I think, everyone in the community. And it's been quite confronting, I think, since COVID, to see signs going up saying, please don't be aggressive.
Yeah.
Come to that point, I think, in society that people are more stressed. There's the cost of living crisis. There's wars everywhere that are deeply confronting, and it's affecting us and how we relate to each other. I think, yeah, those moments of kindness and care can be really powerful and start to shift what's happening more broadly in society, but also have a huge impact on the vulnerable people in our community as well.
Hi, Fiona here. Thanks for taking the time to listen to the XYZ Experiment podcast. And don't forget to leave a rating and review. If you enjoyed our show, tell all your friends and family and subscribe. Follow us on Instagram at the XYZ Experiment for all the latest updates and news. Our original music was composed and performed by Luke Champion.